Hello, everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Hannah. Welcome to CMU Booked, Carnegie Mellon's official book podcast.
This week, we're getting into The Diving Pool by Yoko Ogawa, translated by Steven Snyder. It's a collection of three novellas published in English in 2008. The book won the 2008 Shirley Jackson Award for the Best Collection and was longlisted for the 2009 Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. I really, really loved one of the stories, and I'm excited to talk about all three of them.
It has been on my list for quite a bit now, and I totally agree. Some stories stronger than others, so I think we have lots to discuss.
Absolutely. Enjoy, team! I was home in Florida for most of the break, which was really fun for 4 days. And then on the fourth day, I was like, I need to get out of this godforsaken place.
And on the fourth day, she rested.
Other than that, I also am reading a book called Abolition Feminism Now for my transnational feminisms class. I'm like 50 pages in, and I am terrible at doing nonfiction, but feeling good about getting back into it. Yeah. What about you?
I was hanging out with my friend, had a similar just chill for a few days and then come back to campus. While I was there, I did watch Gone with the Wind. Incredible. Omar Sharif is probably one of the most attractive men to have lived. It is crazy. He is also in Funny Girl for any Omar Sharif fans. But besides that, I mean, I was recently getting into this book called The Diving Pool.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wait, tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I guess you'll just have to wait because we're talking about it today on today's episode. Who is excited?
Me!
So this book is about basically three protagonists in the three respective novellas, The Diving Pool, The Pregnancy Diaries, and then the third one being The Dormitory. It sort of follows these protagonists who are really on the outskirts of their relationships, familially and romantically. The Diving Pool is about young girl whose parents own an orphanage, and she is the only non-orphan. Despite living with them, she develops a big relationship love for her foster brother, and then starts to abuse another one of the foster children. The longest of the three, The Pregnancy Diaries, follows a young woman whose sister is pregnant, and she keeps a diary of everything that's going on in her sister's life and starts to take a keen interest in what said sister is eating, particularly some grapefruit jam. And then Dormitory, the final one, my favorite one, is sort of this gothic Japanese short story about this woman whose cousin reaches out and looking for a place to live while he's at university and asks her where she stayed, and they return to her old college dormitory that has recently had a tragedy occur, which has put it on the outskirts of society. So pretty thick novellas, really about isolation and reckoning with that, both internally and your actions towards those that you care about or are supposed to care about.
Something that I immediately wrote down was the body, which is a bunny reference, sort of, in my opinion.
No, like, the body.
The body.
It's
Let's
a vessel.
Talk about it. But I also wrote down the idea of parasites. I don't know if you got that as much as I did.
I think the idea of being inflicted and infected by something and the decay of humanity when you are lonely, sort of the streamlined thinking that's either violent or resentful. I also think it's really interesting how each of these stories is about caretakers who sort of go awry in that isolation. I want to ask you, in regards to The Diving Pool, with the language being sort of this like rotting, the correlation between liquid and rotting things, mold with the body. Just like, how did you think that language sort of functioned? Because I thought it was like so apparent within the first page that we were going to get super vivid and often vulgar descriptions of things.
This main character uses language to illustrate gross things as beautiful and beautiful things as gross. I think there's this one passage where she's describing mold as being like effervescent, this beautiful naturalistic green. But when she's talking about humans, it's these gross creatures that a lot of times have to do with liquid. I agree with you. There was a big thing about wet versus dry. Like, she loves to use the viscous liquids as a good thing and like a holy thing almost.
I just think that the disgust that you get from the language that she particularly uses with dripping, hollow, things like that, really connect to the sadistic protagonist. The beauty that she talks about through this vulgar language is also the sort of contentment and satisfaction that, say, especially in the first story, Aya, finds in abusing Rey and poisoning Rey with something beautiful like a cream puff. It's that inverse relationship and what's hidden behind that I think is so poignant in each story, but we're definitely introduced to in the diving pool.
And on Aya, do you think that the way she uses language to describe like very human things as gross, is that a manifestation of her own guilt about her humanity?
Yeah, I think it's her perverted mind. Everything is so uneasy because there's subtext, but it's so subtextual that it takes so long to try and figure out what's happening. They talk about how the shaking ginkgo tree is like dripping, and then when she's feeding Jun like the liquid from the tree, breastfeeding. I just think that there are a lot of analogies that create this skepticism and untrustworthiness relative to the protagonist.
Obviously, she's very sadistic and perverted. I believe she calls a child's thighs erotic, and I like this, like 2-year-old or something.
I like the fact that it is sort of perverted and disturbing, because I think the way that those things are reconciled at the end of each respective novella is so different, despite each character having such perverse dialogue and subtext. Even in the dormitory, which isn't as overt, I even thought that the main character, this young wife, when her younger cousin comes to visit, I thought that they had like sexual tension
when they were speaking. I thought I was insane for that.
You are not insane. Thank God you just said that too, because I low-key was like, am I going to be on my own with this? But I think that the unease and everything I thought was connected to this sexual repression, which is, it manifests itself disturbingly for these characters. But honestly, I've been dying to read Exquisite Corpse by Poppy Z. Bright. Mm. So like, I feel like this is a first stepping stone into like the mind of someone perverse. It's like American Psycho, except toned down and about women.
Ooh, I feel like the thing I can connect this most to is the Virgin Suicides, which is still pretty tame. But Virgin Suicides also has a lot of teenagers in weird sexual relationships. That's the only thing I could really connect it to in my mind, even though the diving pool is probably the most perverse of the stories. It's like the diction that makes it that way. It's not even that anything's really happening that's all that crazy, which I think is one of the most impressive things about the story.
And I think that the interplay of religion and what you're talking about familially, like with The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides, I think, is so embedded in these family relationships that then create this ripple effect. Ooh, ripple effect. Shout out the diving pool. it's all about that ripple. And so I thought it was really interesting, the concept of the caretaker and motherhood, which I thought was pretty key in defining our protagonist, especially because on page 12 of the paperback, she talks about the family photographs that are in the lighthouse, which is the orphanage. It says, I gaze at the photograph of my father just as someone might gaze at the altar from the pew. So she's very displaced and becomes sort of a voyeur of this family and this fantasy. And I think that that runs off into her fantastical imaginations about Jun.
What I found interesting is that Aya, we hardly hear about her body. She's very much like dead set on everybody else's body. So I loved the fact that they really hone in on like specific ripples of muscles that Jun has when he's diving into the water, almost like his body is like this machine. And Rey, this is the character that is Aya's roommate, right?
No, that's Rico.
Oh, so sorry.
Ray is the poor... the poor chap who she just totally poisons and sticks into moldy buckets.
Right. She likes John, and so his body is a perfectly well-oiled machine. And this child is disgusting to her, and therefore the body itself is disgusting. Even Aya points out that this child's body, like, has distinct smells that makes them worse in this case than the other children that she's dealt with. I find it interesting, the categorization.
Right. She defines siblings by their bodies. I don't know if it's conscious to not talk about hers as much, just given that we're getting her perception of the world around her, not as much her deepest, most inner dialogue. I feel like she keeps some things at arm's length from the reader. We don't get everything, and their person being defined by how they look. I thought it was very funny, given her parents' soul of religious abnegation. It's all about giving, not taking. That also plays into that sexual repression. She wants him to dive into her. She wants to be filled by him. Yeah. Like, very overtly, she wants to destroy Ray. She didn't really say anything about Rico, her roommate, who she says she's a bigger girl, whatever, but never makes any judgments about how her appearance makes her feel. Mm-hmm. You know, she talks about how her mother's chattiness is just grating, and how her dad is distant and largely absent from her life and not from everyone else's life. And so that, like, Japanese religious zealousness, I think, is how this functions so well in separating the protagonist and having them on the outskirts of these family relationships and dynamics. Do you think that there's a level of self-hatred in, like, the way that she approaches these bodies? How you were talking about Ray, and, like, she calls it buttery thighs, but then she's like, ah, I want to kill it.
She has the feeling, and this might be me projecting onto her, but I think she has the feeling that everything she touches will be destroyed, maybe, and that's why she has to keep herself kind of at arm's length. And that's why when she removes herself from the situation and she can watch it, it's pure, it's perfect, but everything else that she is involved with has that, like, film of self-hatred that she has to remember herself in the memory of it happening.
At the end, she talks about how she can see through the water again, and John exposes her for the sort of criminal action that she partook in. It's so reflective throughout that. And the fact that the sense of wet purity, holiness, she wants to be cleansed by things. And I think that taking herself out of a situation automatically cleanses herself from any responsibility or action, because she's not an agent, really.
Right.
She doesn't have extracurriculars. She's totally alone. Do you think that she gets off on that?
Ooh, I think the idea of the perfect her being in a situation is great, but when it actually comes to fruition, it's awful for her. So what happens at the end of the story is that Jun, like, exposes her for being abusive towards this child, but they have a long, pleasant conversation before this takes place. Why does he wait? Why does he bring it up? Why does he not act more aggressively about it?
Because he understands her more than she thinks she understands him. I think that at the end, we sort of get this dual malevolence with benevolence. Like, he is the pinnacle of her eye, but she also just has so much malice in her heart. And she envies the pain and defenselessness of the orphans.
Mm.
You know, she asks Rico constantly about how her parents are, when she knows Rico doesn't want to talk about it. And I think at the end, we sort of get Jun almost forgiving her, letting her have a way out, and also creating that boundary of, like, now this is your sentence. We have this knowledge about one another. We're probably never going to talk about it again, given that they speak to each other every, like, year or so when they realize that they're siblings. There's one particular line on page 52. He would never dive into the pool inside me, clouded as it was with the little girl's tears. She is filled with the pain of a 5-year-old, 4-year-old, and so she'll never be able to wash herself of this tainted, chlorinated water. She is not the same. She is not the same, and he acknowledges her as that. Do you think he forgives her, or do you think he's almost like, you could just, like, confess to it right now. I'm giving you a way out.
Yeah, no, I don't think he forgives her. I think for him to forgive her, there would have to be an accusation. But in this situation, he is acknowledging what has happened. So I don't think that he necessarily wants, he doesn't want to talk about it. He's giving it as a gift to her to be like, this is our situation and we can be very in the present about it, because she has the tendency to stick into the outskirts. But since he specifically goes out into the rain to find Aya, to, I would assume, have this conversation, because he knows that that's going to be what's best for the both of them. And like we've said, they're siblings. They're going to have to know each other for a long time.
What did you think of them being siblings?
I was so confused.
Someone has never seen the Fosters.
I can't remember which comes first, but whichever one came first, I was like, oh, then the other can't be true. And then they were both true. And I was gobsmacked. No, and then you have to kind of like, you sit in her reality so long that you kind of have to come to terms with the fact that it's like, well, they're not really related. So
No, she's forcing you into this. She is saying that you have to deal with this sort of unconventional relationship. Society does not accept that. I thought immediately of The Royal Tenenbaums, which is the Wes Anderson movie. And, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow and Luke Wilson's characters, I mean, they're adopted siblings and they, like, grew up together and they're deeply in love. And they harm themselves because their ability not to be together. And I feel like her knowledge that they won't be able to be together long term makes her find gratification in others' pain because she feels pain. Mm. And that's why I think she also likes the idea of them being defenseless. She likes when Jun is just in the pool. In the first, like, few pages, she talks about how when he's lying and waiting in the water, it's when he seems the most vulnerable and defenseless, and that's when she feels the most love for him. I think the absence of sexuality in the relationships makes it more of a stilted narrative and less of one that we can trust because of the protagonist and the fact that she's writing a diary.
Something I pointed out was that they kind of hone in, each of the stories hone in on different senses. I would say in the first story it was sight, and in this one it's very much taste and smell. The lack of sexuality, the relationships in this story were like wet cardboard, because nobody really has any strong emotions about anybody.
There is absolutely no passion that is shared. This second one and the third, I feel like, touches more into the idea of moral and physical decay being one and the same. But I thought this was a step in the more surreal and fever dreamy direction, which makes me not fully confident in whether or not something is being described as moldy and gooey and oozy, and that being a metaphor, which I think is evasive rhetorically and confusing. The pronoun usage is confusing. I really enjoyed that. Although this was my least favorite,
agreed,
honestly. Oh, really?
Yeah, I agree. I liked them all sandwiched together. I am going to say that The Diving Pool was my favorite. It was such a strong start. I found myself wishing that it just continued. I was a little bit disappointed when we got to Pregnancy Diary. There's no passion. There's no passion.
There's no passion. And it's also really hard to distinguish what is real and what is not. So it's like, is her perception of this sort of romanceless relationship really what's going on, or is she just resentful and on the outskirts? The notion of mold decay motif, which is reoccurring, the giant amoeba eating up all of the other odors around it. Do you think that that's an extension of Ray in the first story? This sort of parasitical thing that Aya feels herself to have to get rid of?
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, if I can put everything that I don't like in this tiny little box and then set the box on fire, I'll never have to deal with any amount of discomfort again. And so if you're able to compartmentalize and make everything seem manageable, then I would say yes. And I want to say that the amoeba is a manifestation of trying to make those really huge problems more manageable.
It's also a form of cleansing
a problem and sort of washing yourself of it. I think that especially in this story where we have more of one person, we have one person talking about that in the first story. We don't get another perspective. We barely hear their opinions. In the second story, we have sisters and they start to blend into one another at certain points. When she calls it a giant amoeba on page 74, the medical description and sort of the sterile descriptions of her fetus from the perspective of the sister starts to blend into the pregnant sister. Like literally 74, she calls it a giant amoeba. And then on 75, the sister says, I want to go somewhere where nothing smells, like a sterile room in a hospital where I could pull out my guts and wash them clean. You want to wash yourself clean? I thought the protagonist wanted to wash herself clean. Now we're both in it together.
So in dormitory, I loved this story, by the way. It's my second favorite. There was a certain amount of formality between the main character and her cousin. I don't know if that's a context of the culture that we're in or if that's supposed to juxtapose the imagery.
I mean, I think that the separation, the class system of Japan, we just have to be acknowledging that while reading,
totally.
Which I definitely was in this novella, just considering the sort of familial aspect of like a cousin reaching out to you and being like, can I have your information on how you were in college. This was the modern Japanese version of The Fall of the House of Usher, which, if anyone has read, is about the decline of a once wealthy noble family. While their house sort of falls apart, so does their lineage. I thought that that was key in this novella, and especially with the symbolic nature of the manager dying and the very heavy-handed visuality of the empty rooms and the broken corridors, the crumbling offices. I just thought that the coughing and the fragility of him extends to the setting, which is so key in all of these stories. The home, the lighthouse, the hospital, the dorm. Even Sweden, which is where this young wife, the protagonist of the dormitory, is avoiding going to be with her husband. Did you find this protagonist to be lonelier than the others?
Ooh, I feel like outwardly, yes. I think that they were trying to make a bigger point of that. And if you were to do it by how many people are they interacting with, then this main character probably is the most lonely. But I actually got the most sense of loneliness from the first character, Aya, in the diving pool. I think that this character does not act the loneliest despite her situation, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Definitely. She has an escape with the entrance of the cousin, and then she has a purpose as being a caretaker for this manager. I loved this novella the most because it is the most gothic, and one of my favorite elements of it and the most surreal nature is the fact that it is straight up uncanny. Like Freud's The Uncanny, it's all about sort of doppelgangers and the idea of things like unheimlich, things being familiar and unfamiliar at the same time, and the feeling that that renders, which is uncanny. On page 129, it says, in fact, nothing about the scene seemed familiar, and I wondered how much I had forgotten about the dormitory right after being like, I remember everything here. And then nothing feels familiar. And it's because of this change and this shift in sort of the reality of the dorm and its humanity, because there's obviously something sinister that's occurred with the disappearance of not one, but sort of two students.
Oh, this is like the Twilight Zone. She goes back and it's like, imagine you're in the same dormitory, your freshman year dorm, which is crazy, by the way. But with someone who's about to repeat those same experiences as you. And I also underlined that exact line and was like, this is incredible. I feel like it does kind of take a left turn into horror.
I think she chooses a more symbolic, metaphorical ending than a real one, obviously, when she thinks that the house is sort of crumbling after the manager has passed and there's blood dropping from the ceiling. And then she goes out to inspect it and then says, oh, it's just a huge beehive and honey is dripping. I was gagged. I was like, what a wonderful ending, because I feel like we've gotten very straightforward answers to questions in the past two novellas. Even the second one, you get a sense that we don't know if the baby's ruined or not, but we sure know that the sister hopes it is. In this one, we have no idea if anything's even real to a certain extent. Like, and I am curious to know, do you think the manager murdered those young men?
100%.
Same. No doubt.
No doubt about it.
Literally no doubt in my mind. But that was, I mean, like, I love a mystery. I think that this novel as a whole worked really well formatting wise. I agreed with you that, like, this is sandwiched pretty cohesively. And I think that, I mean, always first and last of short stories are going to be the strongest.
I also totally agree. I really, really liked it. I think that they probably could have, it's meaty for a novella, but overall I would totally recommend it to anybody. I'd recommend it to you if you hadn't already read it. Anyone who's into something a little freaky.
Yes. That makes me so happy that you just said that. I mean, like, yeah, I like to be grossed out. I like to be surprised. And the last one definitely surprised me. So hear ye, I recommend. Thanks so much for listening for our CMU question of the week.
If you could swap with any two majors at CMU for a week, which would they be and why?
I would probably try out a business major just for shits and gigs. And then if not that, I don't know. I would love to do like music. Not that I have any modicum of real musical talent, like instruments, no thanks, but that would be fun.
You totally stole my answer. I want to be, get me on stage now.
You're cast in my play.
Oh my gosh. Remember to follow us on Instagram at CMU Booked. Reach out if you want to be a guest. Throw a book at me. I live at...
Come to the library. I'm in Sorrell's.
Okay.
I'll be there. Throw a book at me too. Don't hit me in the head though.
Please. All right. Bye, everyone.